between our Grassmannian formulation and space-time, in the sense of connecting the Grassmannian formulation to something that makes locality manifest. So yesterday, we made a connection between the Grassmannian formulation and twisted string theory. There we said that, and remember, this was in our quest for making a connection between the Grassmannian formulation and something where particles, a notion that we like very much, should be manifest. So this connection was made in the quest for the particle interpretation. And we succeeded because the twisted string theory has a very nice particle interpretation. We have a single space, a CP1, where we have our particles living there. And there was a map of degree n minus 1 into twister space, or super twister space. Okay? And this was supposed to be the scattering amplitude. Once you take this into space-time, okay? And one of the reasons we liked this was that it made manifest several properties that are very, very trivial to see from the point of view of the Lagrangian. One of them was the U1 decoupling identity. And the other one was cyclicity. These two things were very manifest in this formulation. But we also said yesterday that if you're considering maps of degree n minus 1 into twister space, you could also try to go to the boundary of the moduli space and say, well, what happens to a map, say, of degree 2, where you have your nice conic there in twister space, your nice curve of degree 2, and what happens when you go, you're supposed to integrate over the whole moduli space of curves, so what happens when you go to the boundary of the moduli space where your nice conic degenerates, okay? So at the boundary, the degree 2 curve can degenerate, like any nice conic can degenerate into the intersection of two lines. Now, once you are there, you could say, well, isn't that boundary point connecting myself to another moduli space where I have the moduli space now of disconnected curves, whose boundary is precisely where they are connected? Well, that leads you to the idea that perhaps there is also a formulation, or that you were also supposed to consider maps of degree n minus 1, where the map was really into n minus 1 CP1s inside your twister space. Okay? So yesterday we said that this in space-time gave rise to what is called the RSV formula. And this point of view gave rise in space-time to something that is called the CSW diagrams. Very good.
For the
The motivation for the existence of which map? This one.
The second one.
Well, remember that in the formula was not mapping this to a single curve in CP3/4. We also had this integral over the little z's. Do you remember the little z parameters? Mm-hmm. Those integrals were the integrals over the moduli space of these curves in CP3. Okay? Now, at the boundary, it's clear that the boundary of the moduli space will be defined by the points where these
n minus 1 curves is degenerate, right? Say a degree 2 curve, the simplest case, will degenerate into the intersection of two degree 1 curves. But that intersection is actually the place where two different modular spaces connect to each other, right? The modular space of these connected curves and the modular space of connected curves will touch each other there. So you may wonder from that point of view, why didn't you go all the way to the other side? Is there any formulation where you can actually use just these connected curves? After all, that would be simpler than this, in a sense. Yes?
Can you throw away the RSV formula?
What is what?
RSV formula.
Well, it's this very long formula that we wrote down yesterday, saying that we will never try to write it down explicitly or to use it explicitly and show how it's connected to the other one.
It comes from...
That was the thing that came from literally imposing that there is a map. Well, it's not that complicated, really. I mean, all you do is take these points, right? Map them into twister space, and the ZAs impose that the points in twister space are given by where the ZAs are parameterizing the modular space of these curves. So you integrate over the modular space of the curves of degree n minus 1, which is given by the integrals over the little ZAs. Now you integrate over the location of the sigmas, which are the coordinates on the CP1. Where the sigma hat is your favorite map, right? The very best map. So this was a formula in Christmas. Okay, very good. So this motivated the search for a formula that will construct scattering amplitudes, say, for n equals 3. Okay? As what? Well, we know that if we go first to m equals 2, what is the map? The map is of degree 1, right? So we map the sphere, the CP1, into a single CP1. That means that really a CP1 in twister space somehow looks like the place where an MHV amplitude is supposed to live. So this was an MHV amplitude, the part Taylor amplitude we talked about. Is associated
with a CP1 and CP3. Okay. Now, if you want a formula that writes, say, the NMHV amplitudes, as two CP1s in twister space, well, you would expect that such a formula would then have to be something that connects two MHV amplitudes and builds the NMHV amplitude out of two NMHV amplitudes. So somehow, there must be a way in a space-time of connecting one MHV amplitude together with another one and producing the full amplitude here. Have we seen any way of connecting amplitudes together and getting a new amplitude? Well, I hope you remember that. That would be the BCFW way of connecting amplitudes. But if we apply BCFW, remember that MHV amplitudes are those that had the M R charge sector. They are in the M equals 2 R charge sector. Okay? And BCFW has no preference for these guys. Okay? BCFW will construct the amplitude out of pieces that could very well involve the M equals 1 three-particle vertex, the three-particle amplitude, right? So this expansion is not the same as the BCFW expansion. Okay? Well, it turns out that this expansion was discovered before BCFW, the BCFW recursion relations. And at first, it was more or less an empirical fact. You simply try to say, well, let me try to take two MHB amplitudes with particles, say, I plus 1, all the way to j here, j plus 1 all the way to I minus 1. And there is an internal particle here. Somehow I have to find a way of defining an on-shell MHB amplitude here. But in order to do that, remember, all I have to do is to tell you if this is MHB, this is only a function of the lambdas of each of the particles that are participating in the amplitude. So all I have to do is to find a way of faking a lambda of a physical particle and then just plug it in there. The same lambda will apply on the other side. So this would be the left, this would be the right, MHB. And something else must happen here. This amplitude should blow up when you are near the factorization channel, where the amplitude actually factors like this. So you should have a 1 over p squared that contains the momenta I through j. Okay? Now, how could you fake the lambda of a massless particle if all the data that you have is a massive momenta? Well, one way to do it is to take your p I through j, which has components AA dot, okay? Now this is not massless. P squared, the determinant, is not zero. So you cannot write this as lambda, lambda tilde. But one way of extracting or defining a lambda vector from this would be just to take this and get rid of this index. So you can just contract with any reference spinner. And define your lambda in this way. Well, the surprise is that you do that, which is the most naive thing that you can imagine doing. You plug it into this formula and check it and check it and check it again. And you start reproducing all these scattering amplitudes one by one. Moreover, we know that the final answer cannot depend on any reference spinner. The amplitudes don't have that data. However, diagram by diagram, they depend on that reference spinner. And miraculously, at the very end of the day, that reference spinner completely drops out. Okay? Very good. So let's give an example of this. Consider this amplitude. Now we're going to compute a non-supersymmetric amplitude. So we're going to consider this particular amplitude with these helicities. So these are all gluons of minus and plus helicity. Okay? And we want to write it in this CSW way of expanding the amplitude. Okay? Now, it's useful to introduce a notation, which is a pity that this thing went all the way up. Let's do the following. Remember that each of these MHB amplitudes in twistor space, they correspond to a line, to a CP1, okay? So people like to represent a line, a complex line, even if it's a complex line, by just a line. So let me introduce a notation for this to say that this is a line and particles I plus 1 live on that line. Okay? Now, this is another line in twistor space, say I minus 1 all the way to j plus 1. But now it so happens, and we will see it in a moment, that these lines live on a plane. It so happens that they live on a plane, well, a CP2 to be more precise. But we can think about that as a plane. And two lines on a plane, what do they have to do? Well, they have no choice but to intersect, right? So we can think about this new point defined on this line by the other one as being the internal point I that we talk about here. Okay? Now, this is supposed to be MHV, and this is supposed to be MHV as well. The internal line, we can think about that as being an internal particle that is being propagated from one side to the other that is on shell. So if that particle has some helicity on one side, it will have the opposite helicity on the other side. Remember, we can expand the polaris, the propagators really have a metric in the numerator, and we can expand that in polarization vectors. So whatever enters with one helicity on one side, it will enter with the opposite helicity on the other side. So we should try to draw all possible diagrams of that form where we can assign helicity to the internal particles such that on each line we get an MHV amplitude. So that's the rule of the game in order to write all the possibilities to build this amplitude from that. So how can we do that? Well, let's start. Let's make a choice. Say you have on this side you have these particles. Let's put the other particles on the other side. Okay. Can this possibly be turned into an MHV diagram, into a CSW diagram? Well, in order to answer that question, we have to ask, can we give an assignment of the helicity of this particle on this line, which is consistent with this line being MHV, and one on this side, which is the opposite to the one you chose on the other one, so that this line is also MHV? Well, clearly, this one here has only one minus, and MHV amplitudes must have two minuses and the rest pluses. So how can we do that? Well, we just have to declare that this particle on this side looks like a minus. And how about on this side? Well, it has to look like a plus. I don't have a choice. Now I have to check and see, well, it works, right? So two minuses and two pluses. So this is an allowed diagram. Let's continue. Let's try 2 plus 3 minus and say 4 plus.
What's in the space where those lines live?
The space lives in crystal space, but this is just a diagrammatic representation to remind ourselves of the operation we're supposed to do in momentum space. In momentum space, all we have to do is that whenever you see a line, you replace it by an MHV amplitude, where this point represents just.
No, it's clear what to go from there to there. Within crystal space, I want to understand really not talk about the momentum space, but what are these pictures? The CP1 appeared in this map that we introduced last time. Right?
Yes.
So this is you are saying that each line is one CP1?
Yes.
And the particles were points on the CP1, and therefore they are points on the line. Okay, so.
Yes. Okay, so what do we have to do here?
Well, here our internal particle must be a plus and here a minus for this to be an MHV vertex. So how many diagrams are there in total? How many diagrams can we draw? Well, let's keep trying, right? Unless somebody tells me how many diagrams we can draw. Let's put 6 plus here, 4, 5. We have plus and minus. Can this guy be made into an MHV amplitude? Well, yes, if we put a minus here and a plus here. Okay. How many more diagrams do we have to draw? Okay. Once you know the answer, you can tell me. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. That means that the answer to my question is plus 6 more diagrams. Okay. Well, this is much better than the Feynman diagrams that you have to compute in order to get this amplitude, okay, of which there are around 220, I believe. So yes, with nine diagonals, you get this amplitude. Okay, that's very good. Now I want to claim that these CSW diagrams and actually very, very close. Very, very close to a Lagrangian description. Well, you would say, how can it be? I mean, they look very different from Feynman diagrams. How can you get these diagrams from a Lagrangian description? Well, there is first what I would like to call the Mansfield field. And it's the following. Right with Lagrangian. Now, this is really like in field theory, there is nothing fancy, just your regular Lagrangian polynomials, very in light on gauge. So you only have the physical degrees of freedom propagating, okay, plus and minus. So you have to tell me how the interactions look like. Well, it turns out that you have the free part plus an interaction vertex of 2 plus helicity particles and 1 minus, plus an interaction vertex, minus, minus, plus, and the final one we are all familiar with is the 4 particle one. Okay? That is a Lagrangian greeting in light engaged. Now, the trick is the following. You say, well, if I want to get something that looks like an MHV expansion, I don't really want this vertex here. This is precisely the vertex that never appears in the expansion. If it did, it would look like BCFW. But that vertex never appears. Okay. Then they just get rid of that and make a field redefinition. This is a free part. Yeah, I like it very much. Yes. Yeah. No, I didn't say that I'm going to get rid of this. I said I'm going to get rid of this, okay, by performing a field redefinition, okay, which turns this whole thing into the free part of a new field, of a new gauge field B. Now it turns out that once you do this, and you rewrite everything else in terms of B, it turns out that you can only do it in a series expansion. And the price you pay for having getting rid of this guy is that you get an infinite number of interaction terms. But what is nice is that the infinite number of interaction terms that you get are all of the form okay. Well, now you use this Lagrangian and just write down the Feynman rules that come from this Lagrangian, and you will see that the interaction vertices are only interaction vertices that have the structure of an MHV amplitude. Okay? And that will give rise to the CSW expansion. So, what is the way?
People were a bit worried, right? Because the field definition was.
Well, remember, here we're doing 3-level.
Yes.
So the field definition is fine. There is nothing fancy going on.
A priori, what is the status? How could you argue that this could work at the place? Because people did, right?
Yes.
What I know is that people measure, right?
Yes.
So at one loop, there will be a determinant. And
yes, but nobody ever computed that carefully, as far as I know.
So not only field definition, they don't care, right? They don't change their semantics. But this one is special, because analog, right?
No, but not only that, you have to be careful. You really have to compute the Jacobian.
Yes, that's the main thing.
Yeah, but nobody ever did, as far as I know. If anybody knows, but
I thought Mansfield did, no? Okay.
No, you see, the main reason you will suspect that there is something that has to happen that is dramatic is the following. You can do this for pure Jacobians, right? And at one you know that you can compute amplitudes, that amplitudes with all plasticities don't vanish. So how can you, an amplitude at one loop with all plasticities is not zero. So how can you get it from here? Well, it must be an anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there must be something very interesting going on in this field redefinition, if this thing is going to compute those amplitudes as well.
But another thing that makes it not completely obvious from what you have said about Feynman diagram is that here, you know, you don't integrate over the internal propagator. It seems you're putting a given value.
Well, it's something you do in BCFW, right? In BCFW, each amplitude is a given rational function that is completely determined, and the propagator is the same propagator.
Okay. So you're not saying that what you wrote down is the Feynman rules for this theory. What you're saying is that this is the BCFW.
Yes. So these are the Feynman rules for this theory.
So where is the integration over internal momenta?
It's fixed for momentum conservation.
A tree level, isn't it?
Tree level. Okay, right.
No. Let's not get into loop level with that. No,
okay.
I don't really. Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, but there is also the BSM construction, Bohs, Skinner, and Mason.
And if you want to know more details about this, you can ask Dave to give a special series of lectures about that. And what do they do? Well, they realize they build a theory in twister space directly. Okay, that looks like a Chern-Simons action with a gauge field that lives in twister space. And they want to think about twister space, your CP3, as an S2 bundle over S4. Okay, and your S4 will be your Euclidean spacetime. Okay, now your gauge field lives here. And if you want to get an action in a space-time, well, you have choices. You can start from here and perform a gauge choice or a partial gauge fixing, which they call the space-time gauge fixing that lands you directly on the action we know and love. Okay? They also show that you can use that there exists another partial gauge fixing, which introduces, it's like a Lycon gauge, partial gauge fixing for this gauge field. Note that in this space, this gauge field there is more gauge redundancy, okay? So here you have to introduce a Lycon direction on the S2. Well, that is nothing but a spinner, a reference spinner. And they show that you land on the CSW Lagrangian. Okay? So this is also a very direct connection, showing that you can go from one to the other. Once again, this is all manipulations done at the level of the classical action. But I think it's spectacular that, well, at least at three level, the conclusion is that CSW diagrams are as close as you can get to actual Feynman diagrams without actually doing Feynman diagrams. So this is precisely the next step. And it's spectacularly simpler than Feynman diagrams already. Okay?
That it would fail at all, because if it's just gauge fixing, then you don't have such issues like non-local delineation.
My answer to that is the same that I gave before. If you want to know more details about this, you ask Dave to give a series of lectures.
So
why does it fail at all loop level?
You have to be careful about the gauge fixing.
Yeah, the gauge fixing.
There's a holomorphic Chern-Simons part of the action, which is just a Chern-Simons. And if you have a pink vertex in there, is the MHV feedback. The MHV bar feedback, the thing that Mansfield got rid of by his field redefinition. Okay, so we get rid of it by an axial gauge. And that's completely tame at tree level, but you might worry a little bit on it. Propagator might become parallel to the direction of your axial gauge or something like that. In n equals, n equals 1, it doesn't matter, but in n equals 0, it matters. Axial gauge fixing isn't complete gauge fixing, there's some gauge redundancy. It doesn't matter.
Okay, so the discussion gave me time to find out the black person to write the title of what we're going to discuss now. So
let's shift gears a little bit, but we will see that this is completely related to what we were doing. I want to discuss something that is called twistor space localization of the amplitudes. So we knew that already that MHV amplitudes from this discussion are localized on spheres. So that led Witten ask the question, could it be that NMHV amplitudes have a nice localization in twistor space and so on? And that kind of questions led him to more or less this description here. But let's try to see what can we possibly mean by this. And yes.
The object of the previous lecture is new grass name.
Yes. Okay. How do you know? Let's actually write this object, the one we had last time. But written in dual twistor space. Okay? Where V.
So now there is a contour of integration. V must be zero. So we are summing over all the residues of this object on the zeros of this polynomial V. And V, remember, was this Veronese operator that we defined, which is given by 2, 3, 4, 4, 5, 6, 6, 1, 2. 1, 3, 5, minus 1, 2, 3, 3, 4, 5, 5, 6, 1, and 2, 4, 6. Okay? Very good. Now let's take this, as we did yesterday, and send it to twistor space. Okay? Very good. So in twistor space, remember we have the integration over the little z's. Three of them. And then we have our object. So I'm not going to write everything explicitly this time here. And we have our delta function that tells us that the point ZA must live here. The dotted dots is this. No. I'm taking this formula to twistor space. Exactly this formula. I'm not doing anything to the mesh. I'm just Fourier transforming with respect to WA. Do you remember? That's what we did yesterday. We just straightforwardly Fourier transform the WAs, all of them, and that's the source of these delta functions. Because then we wrote these guys in terms of their integral representation, and for that we have to introduce the three little z's, swapping the integrations and performing the W integrations led us to these delta functions.
You will go to the c-hats, then you will get the sigmas.
Yes, but there are no sigmas anymore in this description. Yeah, very good. Okay.
Yeah, I agree. This doesn't look that pretty. That looks better. Yes, first. And say, let this be mu c. Okay, great. Now we have this. Now the claim is the following. This object is not a function. It is a distribution. Thank you. Yeah. Very good. So how do I know that something is a distribution? Well, let me give you an example. Imagine we have our object 3D, which is a function of the Z. And now we just take the bosonic part of the Z and do the following. Multiply this by this object. Say Z1i, Z2j, Z3k, Z4l. Okay? I multiply this by this. Okay? This is a non-zero quantity, right? This is just a polynomial in the bosonic variables contracted in this funny way, but this is clearly non-zero. It's just a polynomial. Now, what do I get when I multiply this by this? Well, let's see. If we do that, we can pass it through the integration. It's just a polynomial. We just put it here and realize that each of the ZAs is a linear combination of these things. Okay? So this is the same as an integral. Now I can replace each of the Zs by their corresponding linear combination in terms of the little Zs. But how many little Zs do we have? Three. Very good. And I'm contracting four of them with an antisymmetric tensor. So I clearly get zero. Okay? So our object P must be a distribution that is localized, okay, that has support only in the places where the twisters are not generic twisters in CP3, but this means that the twisters live in CP2. So we need all the twisters to live in a CP2 inside CP3. That's why we say that these amplitudes are localized on a plane. So our 6 points must be localized on a plane. But do we know anything else about the localization of these points on the plane? Are they random 6 points on a plane? Could this object be telling us something more about this? Well, let's define the following polynomial, f. Let's define it as FABC. Okay? You just choose, it's basically the same polynomial here, but let's choose just a component 1 and say JKL, okay, of ZA, ZB, ZC, and you put here JKL. Okay? This is just a polynomial made out of the Zs. What happens when I multiply my object T with this polynomial? Well, let's try to see. If you have FABC times T, what happens inside the integral? Well, this time I don't get zero, right? Because I only have three objects. But since I only have three objects, when I take the three guys that participate, okay, the contraction is antisymmetric, so everything is going to be proportional to JKL, one of the little Zs, okay, of the three guys that we have. So it's going to be something that contains the three guys. But how about the Cs? What's going to happen to the little C dependence? Yeah, excellent. We get a determinant. We get a minor. Which minor? Well, the minor ABC. It's a minor of this 3 by M matrix obtained by choosing the columns A, B, and C. We just get that. So this polynomial, all it does is to put this minor inside the measure. Okay. Now we can do the following. We can take the polynomial f 2, 3, 4, f 4, 5, 6, f 6, 1, 2, f 1, 2, 3, minus, you can guess what? And what do we get? We get 0. But we get 0 in an interesting way, right? Because we multiply by this, we produce a corresponding minus in the numerator, and we precisely produce v in the numerator, we kill it, but this integration was supposed to be done on the zeros of v, but this function has become regular. So there is no residue, and we get 0. Okay? But we also know that this was precisely the condition on the points z, was precisely the condition for the points on a plane to live where? To live on a given conic. So our 6 points are actually on a conic. They are not only on a plane, but they are localized on a conic. Okay, very good. But let me just ask the following question. What happens if I multiply by f1, 2, 3, f3, 4, 5, and f5, 6, 1? Yeah,
it gets 0, 2. Right, because now we can use the global residue theorem, or the residue theorem applied to the whole thing, and show that this is equal to an integral where we sum over the zeros of this, but that polynomial precisely brings these guys in the numerator and we kill them, so we must also get 0 from here. But yesterday, remember the big deal about t was that it's cyclic. Okay? So we can shift all the labels if we wanted to, and we should get the same object. So we conclude that the same t must also give you 0 if you multiply by anything of the form I plus 1, I plus 2, f, I plus 2, I plus 3, I plus 4, and f, I plus 4, I plus 5, I plus 6, should also give you 0. Now here is a nice exercise for you, is to show that, or find the configuration of lines on a plane that gives you 0 whenever the points are on that configuration, and you evaluate these polynomials. Okay? Well, I'm going to give you the answer. But I want you to check it. I'll give you an example of such a configuration. Okay? Say you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Put particles 1, 2, 3 on a line, 4, 5, 6 on a line. Remember, they are on a plane, so they intersect. Well, clearly, this one gives you 0 here, right? Because this vanishes whenever 3 points are collinear. So this is 0. This is not 0, and this is not 0. You'd say, no, no, but this surely will not work for the next one, right? Shift all the labels over by 1. I'm claiming that everything must be annihilated. You must get 0 whenever you have polynomials of this form here. Well, let's shift all the labels by 1. Now what happens? This one becomes 4, 5, 6. But 4, 5, 6 are on a line as well. Okay? And you also get 0. Now keep on doing it, and you can show that this will just give you 0 all the time. Okay? Now your exercise is to show that precisely all the diagrams that we were drawing for CSW are the only diagrams that are consistent with this localization in twister space. So how can it be? We found somehow a connection between this and this.
Well, this is the first hint that these formulas, Grassmannian formulas, okay, this is something that was very non-obvious from the original twister space formula, the one with the sigmas, the one that Pedro liked so much, right? So this connection between the fact that this formula knows about the conic and also knows about the localization in CSW configurations was very, very non-trivial, and it only became manifest once we introduced the Grassmannian degrees of freedom and the redundancy it has, okay? Any questions? Okay.
Number three here.
Yes.
So, what about the higher end?
Well, that's an interesting question, and the answer is no. So at higher m's, then you will have a richer structure of operators that are telling you a very interesting connection between localization in twister space and localization in a new auxiliary space. Remember that in the Grassmannian, we are always mapping from, we are using maps from C1, CP1, or if you want C2, into CM, right, or CPM minus 1, right? So that map is very manifestly related to twister space localization when you have CP2 or CP3, which is M equals 3 and M equals 4. When you go higher than that, there is still a nice connection between the localization in that auxiliary space and the localization here, but now the localization in the CPM minus 1 is more transparent. There you have enough room to actually see planes localizing in intersections of lines and much more richer structure. Okay.
But don't you have to further show that this formula factorizes in the particle MHP to really show that there's a CSW amplitude?
Oh, sorry, sure. So we have to we should try to do something more than just seeing this localization, right? So let's try to be more precise. Just to make Sujay happy. Okay. So let's actually try to be very, very precise about the connection. In fact, so the connection would be through, of course, our favorite object, L. Okay. Now we know how to connect T to L, so we can use L. In fact, so the whole lecture started by saying that we wanted to discover a spacetime starting from the Grassmannian formulation, but the Grassmannian formulation where we had all the consecutive minors and which was Yangian invariant. This other formulation is not Yangian invariant, okay? The residues of T are not Yangian invariant by themselves. Only the sum is. So we would like to connect this formula, whose residues are at three level, give you the BCFW terms, all of them are Yangian invariant. We would like to connect this to the CSW diagrams that we discussed before, and thus making the connection to space-time manifest, okay? So that would be the goal. But in order to do that, let's actually do N here, and let's write the formula in momentum twister space. So remember, we have to pull out the super MHP amplitude. And we can introduce another object. We can call it R, T, N. And these are in this case, it's particularly simple. Remember, when we have N equals 3, from the point of view of R, if you wish, we should call this 1, because remember that R, or the momentum twister formula, was given in terms of n minus 1 n, where this was called k. This is what Nima has been using all the time, the k. And for n equals 3, this becomes 1. So this is nothing but an integral over a bunch of variables. One by one minors, if you wish. Well, these ones are the momentum twisters, okay? These ones are very different from the twisters that we've been discussing up to now. So remember, these ones are momentum twisters. And I have to tell you, I don't know if we discussed that very carefully. Probably we didn't. Probably we just mentioned it. But the remember,
the components of this is what? The Z is lambda.
Where this mu was related to lambda tilde.
Just linear combination.
By this formula.
And similarly for eta, was related also to the previous equals.
That's right. The original formula had a 3 times n here, a matrix C alpha A, and it had 3 by 3 minors. Okay? Now you may ask, how a residue of this integral goes down to a residue of this integral. What is the map? Okay. Well, to define a residue of this integral, we only had to tell you where n minus 5 of these minors were vanishing. Okay, so we had to choose n minus 5 of these minors, set them to 0, and that gave us a point, and we could compute that residue there, because this secretly was an integral over n minus 5 variables. After all the delta functions were used, this was an integral over n minus 5 variables. Now, certainly these minors should be related to the minors that we have here. And the connection is very simple. If you have the minor I plus 1, I plus 2, vanishes, this is if and only if, in this picture, the I plus 1 vanishes. Okay? The way to remember is the middle one. Okay? Remember, we are removing two dimensions from these minors. The only natural way to remove it is one from the beginning and one from the end, if you wish. So if you have k by k, n by n minors, so you remove the first row and the last row, the first column and the last column, and you end up with a k by k minor, which is in this case is just a di. Now, using this, we can translate the formula that we had for all MHV amplitudes, LMHV amplitudes in terms of this. Remember, the formula was the 3 level was the sum over all even, odd, even, odd. Okay? But this was in terms of the minors of this object. If we now go back to the momentum twisters, we can go to a formula that in terms of the new minors will look like odd, even, and so on. Okay? But keeping track of this odd, even, and so on is a little bit, it's a little bit of a pain. I mean, it looks very complicated, and it would be better for large n, instead of telling you which minors vanish, wouldn't it be simpler if I told you which minors don't vanish? The ones, how many minors don't vanish? We have n minors in the denominator, and we have to set to 0 n minus 5. So how many minors don't vanish? Only 5. So for a small n, that's why we have been doing it like this, because for a small n, it's actually easier to tell you how many minors vanish, right? Like for 6 particles, we tell you minor 1, minor 3, and minor 6 vanish. I mean, we sum these 3 terms, and that's easy, right? But if we're discussing 100 particles, it's clearly better to tell you which minors don't vanish. So let's try to go from the minors that vanish to the description where the minors don't vanish. So let's try to write the formula in terms of the minors, the 5 minors that don't vanish. Okay? So in order to do that, Let's try to give a graphical representation. Imagine you have particle M here, 1, 2, 3, and so on. And let's color the minors that we use in the definition, and let's leave and color the ones, the five guys that we will not use. Okay? Let's see if we can recognize any nice pattern. So we know we are supposed to start with odd and then even, odd and even. So imagine that we start with 1. We use this one, and we use this one. This is fine. Say we use this one, and keep going. And at some point we decide, oh, well, let's not use this one, right? You see what we're doing? We're trying to find a way to describe each of the terms here, not in terms of n minus 5 numbers, but in terms of the five guys that I'm not using in the list. Okay? So I start, and I'm choosing one of those sequences, and say, well, in that sequence I have odd, even, I'm using 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. But at some point I have to skip something, right? Brilliant, that's pretty good, yeah. So if I skip this guy, I have no choice but to skip the next one, right? Because if this guy was odd, I have to choose another odd guy, but this one is even. So I have to skip two guys. So I keep going, and I choose to skip this guy, but once again, following the same argument, I have to skip the next one, and then I keep going. But I can only skip five guys, okay? So I'll be forced to skip the only possible, if I skip any other guy here, I'll have to skip the next one. So the only possibility that I have is that n will have to be skipped, okay? So if you denote this by I minus 1, and this j minus 1, then we just have a sum over I and j, and that would be our entropy, okay? Now we know that each of these terms are BCFW diagrams, but just out of curiosity, let's try to see what their twistor space localization is. Okay? Just to see how far we are from having something that looks local. We know that CSW diagrams are very, very close to a local description. So if we look at the twistor space localization, maybe we can give some hints. We can get some hints and see how far we are from getting something that is local. Well, let's look at this. This minor, if you look at the original description, is where minor n1 and 2 vanishes, right? So this one is telling us that n1 and 2 is equal to 0. But that being 0 means that in twistor space, n1 and 2 are on a line. Is that clear? The reason is that if you multiply by that polynomial, you will produce this minor in the numerator, hitting the pole, and when you compute the residue, you get 0. Okay? So you get n1, 2. Now, this minor is telling you that 1, 2, and 3 are collinear. But these guys were collinear, therefore 3 must be on the same line. So we go all the way up to here, and this minor tells me that I minus 3, I minus 2, and I minus 1 are all collinear. So I minus 1 must be here. Okay? Now we continue. This is I plus 1. Now there is no connection here. There is no way of concluding that I and I minus 1 are on the same line with anybody else here, right? Because we're skipping 2. So that means that we have to start from scratch again and draw a new line that contains I plus 1, and I plus 2. Right? That's what this is telling us, that I plus 1 and I plus 2 are on a line. Of course, these two lines are on a plane, so they meet. And now we keep going until we reach this guy that tells us that j minus 2, j minus 1 are on a line. Okay? Very good. This is looking great, right? It's looking like the CSW localization. Are we gonna get it? Do you think? We better know, right? Because then the whole story of this week will be meaningless. This is supposed to be very non-local, supposed to be very, very, very different from the CSW localization.
Well, indeed it is, because you see, here we get another break. So we cannot conclude that the next particles are on the same line. So we have to start again from a new line. Just 1 second, so J is here, J plus one, J plus two, and we continue. Oh, but no, here. We don't have two guys here to skip, we only have one. So what's gonna happen? M minus one, M minus two, and N must be on the same line. And we get this picture. Looks very nice, but it's not a CSW picture. We multiply by that, by the Z, by the corresponding F. The multiplication brings down a minor to the numerator, which is that minor. You kill it in the denominator, but you're computing the residue right there. So the residue must vanish. And then you conclude that the points must be such that this guy vanishes. Okay, very good. So somehow, what we're seeing here is that each term has a more generic localization than the CSW diagram localization, right? So if we could just impose more localization properties on this, we would make a connection to the CSW diagrams. If we could somehow impose more conditions on this, if we could somehow get rid of this node, for instance, we would immediately discover that all the particles are, if we could color this point as well, we would discover that all these guys must be on a line, and these guys must be on a line. So we would get a CSW localization. But how can we do that? We exhausted all the delta functions that we had, okay? We can only produce N minus 5. We only have N minus 5 conditions. So it seems that we are stuck, that there is no possible connection between one formula and the other. Okay? But here is the trick. Take that formula. Take the formula for a particular residue where we have already used N minus 5 guys. Okay? So let's write the formula for a particular residue. So this will be a given residue. In terms of this, we will be left with some minors that we haven't used. So by that, let me denote that by a line on top of them. These are the minors that I'm not using, okay? So here I've been using the notation, writing the minors explicitly, the ones that are vanishing. So here I'm gonna write the 5 guys that don't vanish, okay? Let me denote them by A1, A2, A3, and A4, and A5. And this integral is the integral dA1 up to dA5 over dA1 up to dA5, and we have the delta functions. Let me just write the bosonic part. I'm not gonna worry about the fermionic part, that will be sitting somewhere there. Yes, I'm taking one term in this sum. Just one, and I'm denoting that term by the 5 minors that don't vanish. Okay, very good. So this is something that by now you should be able to compute right away, right? You should immediately tell me what it looks like. Well, the operation that I'm about to perform can be done to any residue. It doesn't care that it's of that form. Okay, so this is just a generic operation that we're going to perform on this. And it's the following. Remember, these delta functions are bosonic delta functions, and they are imposing constraints on the disk. So we could think about a delta function in this context, and it's actually much more appropriate to think about that. You should have been complaining, because we have been talking about these as being contour integrals, and every variable is a holomorphic variable, right? These are complex variables. And yet, I'm writing a delta function. So you should have complained and said, what do you mean by that delta function, really? Right? It's a little bit funny. You have complex numbers inside. Yeah, maybe it isn't a delta function, really. And what we are supposed to do with that is not to think about that as a delta function, but to think about that as a pole. And we're computing a residue, okay, where we are using those four poles as regular poles, as we were using the other ones, okay? So that's what I want to do. And in fact, that is what we were supposed to do from the beginning. But this is just a mnemonic to remember that we can just, in order to get Yangan invariants, we can just immediately use this and compute a residue that would be Yangan invariant. So the moment I choose something to write down this delta function in the denominator, somehow I lose the manifest dual conformal invariance, right? So that's also the reason to write it as a delta function, to keep the manifest dual conformal invariance. Yes, the CSWS function that I had before. Yeah, that's true. Well, So in twister space, remember that you don't do anything to the lambdas, right? So when you go to twister space, well, we don't even have to have that discussion, right? Because I told you how to translate residues of what we're doing now to residues of this formula, which can be taken directly to twister space without going through any MHV factorization. Okay? So that's why I did this, just to remind you how to translate conditions on these minors into conditions on these minors, and therefore into some localization in twister space. Okay? Very good. So let's try this out. Imagine that we separate this. Now this will come in handy. Z's have lambdas and mu's. So we're going to separate this delta function
as follows, as a sum over the piece that contains the lambdas and the piece that contains the mu's. Okay? Well, clearly, any operation that I'm going to perform on this thing, treated as false, will break manifest dual conformal invariants. Okay? I mean, I cannot do something to the four guys at the same time. I'll have to do things one by one. So there is, as I said, that's the reason why we kept this as a delta function. Okay? Now, what we want to do is the following. We want to choose two reference spinors, zeta and chi, say. These are reference spinors, and any spinor can be expanded in terms of the reference spinors. You can compute the coefficients, and what you get is see what I've done? This is a two-vector. I can choose any reference two-vectors and expand any two-vector in that basis. And these are the coefficients that I get by contracting. Say, I contract this one with chi, okay? If I contract this one with chi,
I get mu chi, and on this side I get chi mu. That cancels this up to a minus sign, but then I get the equality between this and this. So that's a way to check that this expansion is correct. Now, if I do that, this delta function will turn into what? Will turn into the product of two delta functions. So let me write them. It's not a good place to write them. Let's do it here. Okay? So those two delta functions become sum over I from 1 to 5 dAi of what? Of mu AI chi times a delta function sum over I from 1 to 5 dAi mu AI times the other vector. And of course, I have to pay a price. I have to pay a Jacobian. And the Jacobian is just this. Now that I've done this, I can really think about one of them as a pole. Yes? Sorry? Oh, you think that it should be a square? No, I just have to do a little computation, and that's what it turns out to be. Now, yeah. So I want to do this for this guy. I want to think about this as a pole, okay? So I keep everybody else as a delta function. So now I want to think about this as a pole. Which I'm going to call D, just because I'll spend all the rest of my time writing the whole thing if I don't give it a name. So let's call it 1 over D. And what is the formula? Well, we find that our formula is A1, A2, A3, A4, and A5 bar is equal to the integral over the D's. With our new pole D, and we're evaluating this at D equal to 0, right? It's a contour integral, nothing fancy. With our other delta functions that we have here, and the remaining one, that is this one over here, and our extra factor. Okay? But note that this is something interesting. We just have produced a pole out of nowhere. We now can play games like residue theorems. Okay? We just produced this pole, and this is supposed, just that diagram is supposed to be this evaluated on this pole on a one-dimensional complex plane. We are evaluating at the pole where D is equal to 0. But as a function of a complex parameter, now we also have, together with this guy, we have 5 other poles where these other D's vanish. Okay, and this is our contour at the moment. Well, let's take our BCFW term over there and blow it apart, okay, into pieces. Let's use a residue theorem and deform this contour and pick up these 5 contours, okay? So let's write this formula, this integral, as a sum over these 5 poles instead of using the pole that we have here. Okay? So we like to talk about that as taking a BCFW term or one of these Yang-Yang invariant objects and doing something very violent to it and blowing it apart into pieces. Of course, the pieces will not likely have any of the nice properties that the original object had, but probably do. They might do something else that is interesting. So let's try and see what happens. Okay? Yes, very good. But here, remember that we are imposing the delta function here. We are taking it as truly as a delta function. So we have a GL1 redundancy. We have 5 variables. GL1 kills 1. And there are 4 delta functions. So this is not an integral. We just compute a Jacobian. And this is what Lima computed. This is the R invariant, right? These R invariants that are appearing all over the place. Now, what we're doing here is saying we have 5 integration variables. There is a GL1 that removes 1. There is only 4 integration variables. There are 3 delta functions which we are imposing right away. That kills 3. And we're left with 1 variable, which we're fixing just because, as a function of that remaining variable, we're choosing a contour that fits D equal to 0. Okay? Now we can perform a contour deformation and write it as a sum of 5 guys. But you see what's going to happen. Each of those 5 guys is setting one more minor to 0. Just one more minor to 0. We are relaxing the condition that D is equal to 0, but we are imposing that one more minor vanishes. But remember that minors vanishing is precisely the engine that is producing localization in twister space. So we are imposing that these new terms that we're getting, by blowing apart this into bits and pieces, each of them somehow have better localization in twister space than the original object we started with. Okay? So let's see what happens. Let's actually do an example.
N equals 5. There's 5 particles. Okay? Let's start with 5 particles. Then with how many guys we have to choose to set to 0 in the original setup, N minus 5. So we don't have to choose anything to be set to 0. And therefore, these guys are precisely the 5 minors that we have. Okay? Very good. So this is an integral that we're writing now. It's a contour integral over one complex parameter, d tau, that has the minus 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and our d here. Okay? Now, when we use the contour around d equal to 0, our 5 points in twister space, all they have to do is to lie in a plane. Now remember, we know that they have to lie on a conic, but 5 points on a conic, there is no condition. Any generic 5 points lie on a conic. That's why we don't have to set anything to 0. There is no condition really. Okay? But now let's write this as minus the sum of the same thing. But now where we set minor I to 0. Right, we're using a residue here. Now, what happens in twister space? Well, the first term where we set minor 1 to 0, minor 1 equal to 0 means what? Means that particles 5, 1, and 2 are on a line. Now you would say, oh, this doesn't look nice because particles 3 and 4 are not constrained to do anything. Well, but 2 points always define a line, right? And we are in CP2, we're on a plane. So this line will always meet the next line. Well, this looks like a CSW deck. Okay, so this is where minor one vanishes. How about the next one? It's minor two vanishing. This is where points 1, 2, and 3 are on a line, and then 4 and 5 are generic. But they define a line which on a plane intersects the previous line, so it's also CSW diagonal. So we have found that by this operation of blowing apart the residue, just the PCFW diagram residue, blowing it apart into pieces, we are finding that we're getting CSW diagrams. So this is great, so maybe we're on the right track. So as usual, after it works in the first case, you try the next one, and if it works, then you're done. So let's try the next case and see if we get lucky. We better get lucky, right? Because we're running out of time. So let's try n equals 6. This is more interesting, right? Well, for n equals 6, let's try the same. In n equals 6, we know that our amplitude is giving us the sum of 1, 3, and 5. Okay? Let's now write the first term in our new fancy notation, which looks stupid for 6 particles, but it's good when we have many, many particles, right? So in our fancy notation, 1 is the same as 2, 3, 4, 5. And 6 bar, okay? But now remember that we have introduced this new pole. So it's actually more transparent to write this thing like this. Right, because we're also setting D to 0. In this definition of the residues, we're setting minor 1 and minor D, or this pole D to 0. Right? So we can put it here, D. By a residue theorem, this happens to be equal to minus, say, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, D. Where we have put D inside the line, and we have pull out 2. Now this would be, is minus 2, say, 3, 4, 5, 6, D. Okay? And 5 other terms. So let's have a look at this one. Okay? Remember, this was all where minor 1 vanishes. Okay? So we could also have written it like this. Here. And put it here explicitly. Since we only have 6 particles, we can write everything explicitly. Okay? So let's now look at this guy. So minor 1 vanishing is always telling us that particles 6, 1, and 2 are on a line. Now we are imposing that minor 2 also vanishes. Minor 2 vanishing, remember, imposes that the particle 2 with its neighbors, they are all on a line in twisted space. So that means that 1, 2, and 3 are also collinear. So 3 must be here. But it seems we are out of luck, because 4 and 5 are unconstrained, but not. That's good. That's precisely what we need. Because this is a CSW diagram. So you could just stop here and say that this is great, and we don't have to do anything else. But let's check one more just in case. Okay? Just to be completely sure that we're on the right track. So once again, there is minor 1 vanishing. So we have 1, 2, and 3. Now we have minor 3 vanishing. Sorry. Minor 1 vanishing means 6, 1, and 2. Okay? Now we have minor 3 vanishing that says that particles 2, 3, and 4 are collinear. Well, 2, 3, and 4 being collinear, the way to draw it, I guess, something like this. This is still looking good. But how about particle 5? There is no constraint on particle 5, so particle 5 must be anywhere. It can be anywhere it likes. So this is bad news. Okay.
about the next one? The next one is 6, 1, and 2. Now, this is a moment when you have to have faith. You say, well, it doesn't work. If it had worked, I have declared victory. It doesn't work, so let's hope that there is something else that happens that saves the day. So you start with 6, 1, 2. Then the next one is when you relax 4. Okay? 4 means that particles 3, 4, and 5 are on a line, but now these two lines intersect. You say, well, I should be doing something right. About the next one? So let's actually denote this one by the minor that vanishes, 1 and 2. This one, we had minors 1 and 3 vanishing, and here we had minors 1 and 4 vanishing. Okay. Okay, so how many, okay, let's continue. What is the next one? The next one is 6, 1, 2. This is minor 1 vanishing. We need minor 5 vanishing. 5 means that 4, 5, and 6 are on a line. But then 3 is somewhere there. So this is bad. So bad guys against good guys, it's now 2 to 2. It's not looking good. So we have 1 and 6, our last chance, I guess, of getting something interesting. So we have 6, 1, and 2. Now, minor 6 is telling us that 5, 6, and 1 are on a line, and 3 and 4 are unconstrained. So this is good. So we got 3 good guys and 2 bad guys. Not bad. Not that good, but it's not that bad. But remember, how many CSW diagrams do we need? 9. And from blowing apart one of the 3 residues, we just blew apart this guy. We got 3 good guys. So it's conceivable that we will get 3 good guys from here and 3 good guys from this. And those will be the 9 guys we need.
In sort of the opposite order.
Yeah. Right, so you're done. So from this guy, we're going to get now minor 3 and minor 1 vanishing, but in the opposite order. And remember, we did all this business about residues with a determinant to argue that they were anti-symmetric. Right? So from this guy, we will also get this guy, but in the opposite order. So we will get 3, 1, which will cancel one of the bad guys. How about the next bad guy? It was 1, 5. But from here, we will get 5, 1. And that will cancel the next bad guy. Okay? Likewise, all the bad guys cancel pairwise, cleanly leaving only 9 terms. And those 9 terms are precisely the 9 terms in CSW. So, blowing apart the residues using these residue theorems has succeeded in doing something very interesting. It's taking the non-local pieces completely apart. So it's like a surgery. You're taking the bad things, the non-local pieces, apart from the residues, and it allows you to see explicitly how they cancel nicely. So I just need 5 more minutes, and we can take the general case and apply the same logic to the general case. So for each of these guys, imagine we use, again, our residue theorem, right? And then we color. What we want to do now is to take our D, relax D, right? And relaxing D, by relaxing D, what do we do? What we do is that we allow our freedom to color one of the guys here. So imagine that we color N, but that's what we wanted, right, from the beginning. We wanted the possibility of coloring N. So if we color N, this precisely splits into 2 lines, and that's guaranteed to be a CSW diagram. So if we color N, that's a CSW diagram right away.
What happens if we color this guy? I minus 1. So if we color I minus 1, this doesn't look like a CSW diagram, right? But there is another term that has an I minus 2, an I minus 1, let's see if I get it right. Imagine, let's see, what do I want to color? Let's see. If I color this guy, which first step? Oh, yes. Right, so we are relaxing this on each of these guys. These are the five guys that are not used, right? The five minors that are not used.
Now, yeah, so we can relax this by a contour deformation. We can replace this guy and color this guy. So this guy was colored at the beginning, if you wish, right? This was used. Now I want to uncolor this guy and write it as a sum of five terms where I color this guy. The next term I color this one, the next term I color this one, and so on. So I get five terms. One, the first one where I color n is obviously a CSW diagram. Right? Now what happens when I color this guy? Okay? This one doesn't look that good, right? It's still something that has three disconnected regions, so it will have three lines. So if I color this one, I end up with something that looks like this, which doesn't look that good. But in the sum, there is another term that started this slide as follows. Right. There was that term too in the sum. There is another term that looks like that. So this is this one after we color I minus 1. But there is another term that looks like this. When we relax the B, we are coloring the five guys here one by one. So there is one where we color I plus 1. But now these two diagrams look the same, right? But once again, with the opposite order. So they will have opposite signs, and they will cancel each other. So the contribution from this term, from the term where we started without this guy, and the contribution of this term where this guy was colored and these two guys were not colored. Now by coloring this guy
and coloring this guy, I end up with the same diagram, but just by the same logic there, the minors are in the opposite order, so we get zero for these guys that are non-local. Okay? And doing it to everybody, we're going to get only CSW diagrams. Okay? So this proves that by relaxing this and blowing apart every residue in terms of five, we get something that is and we have discovered our space-time description, which is what we want. Yes. Yes.
Whenever we have three regions, three uncolored guys.
I guess the question is if you have four of these initially. Is that the question?
You want which operation do you want?
After you play CSW, can you localize any more than another region?
Yeah, you could. Yes, you could. Nobody has heard it, but yes, you could relax another delta function.
Then it looks like you're going to put everybody in the same line. No?
Yeah, that would be interesting. I don't think anybody has pursued.
There are four of these, right? And you relaxed one, but you could relax two, and you could continue to impose.
Indeed.
You know, yes. To color all the small DIs, but then it means that everybody looks like everybody wants to be in the same line.
Which looks strange, and I don't know what it is. So that would be an interesting direction to pursue.
So anybody has tried that?
I don't think anybody has tried that.
Previously, you called it cultural gate shifting, the Lyapunov gate shifting. What happened to the gate shifting in crystal space?
Sorry, can you say that again?
Can you start by describing the CSW before the partial gauge fix in the life on gauge in Christmas space?
Yes.
What was the rest of the block gauge?
No, this is literally what you do in Lycon gauge. You just use Lycon gauge and you are left with only your physical, two physical degrees of freedom. Mm-hmm. And then that works out. And the Lycon direction is precisely the reference spinner that you get.
Or is, why do you call it partial?
Once again, all the details will be beautifully explained in the series of lectures that they sent with you. But that was not in the Mansfield description. It was in the twister space description. You started with a gauge field that lives in six dimensions. Okay? So that gauge connection in six dimensions has more redundancy. So what you do there is that you partially gauge fix and you leave only the remaining part, which is the gauge degree of freedom in the four-dimensional theory. That's why I call it partial gauge fixing. Okay? Or I didn't do that. Dave and friends call it partial gauge fixing, which is true, which is what it is.
Sorry, okay. But that reduces that partial gauge fixing reduces the twist reaction, so they're completely normal.
Yeah.
If to get these, you just do axial gauge in twister space. Same place, same time, Monday morning.
Same time. Okay. So let me end by concluding my orbit.
By saying that. So we found this Grassmannian description in part motivated by the strange properties of these VCFW terms. So we found that a nice description where these VCFW terms for three-level amplitudes ended up being residues of this object. Now, these VCFW terms are particular examples of leading singularities. And all these guys first were proven here and later on proven here to be invariants of a Jungian algebra. Okay? But now we understand that the Jungian invariants can only come from here. So that means that there is a precise connection between the residues of this object and leading singularities, and therefore to VCFW terms. Okay? We also made a connection to the twister string. In terms of this object, T. Okay. And the connected prescription, or the RSV prescription, for computing amplitudes in space-time. Today, and this was motivated by searching for a particle interpretation, trying to find particles, we also found this description in terms of maps and adding one particle at a time, okay, just within the context of the Grassmannian itself. So this was also looking for particles. Today we were looking for the space-time, and we found a precise connection just by doing the opposite. Here you could think about VCFW terms or this object as combining VCFW terms or the microscopic building blocks into big objects, which were the residues of the Veronese operators here, giving you these nice properties, U1 decoupling identity and cyclicity. And here we did quite the opposite. We took the VCFW terms and we blew them apart into pieces. It was such a violent thing that the local pieces completely were separated from the non-local pieces, and the non-local pieces completely canceled among each other cleanly, leaving just the CSW diagram expansion. Okay? Which in twister space come from the disconnected CP ones. Okay. Now Nima is going today to finish the story of how to get from here the integrand of the whole theory. In a manifestly Jungian form. Okay? And there is something I didn't talk about, and the reason is that I don't know the answer. And it's the connection between this and this. To the Wilson loop story of Alday, Maldacena, where our friends here, Amit, Pedro, and Gayotto have been working on. Okay? So here, this is a dual description where instead of computing the scattering amplitude, you compute the expectation value of a Wilson loop with like-like segments. And it would be spectacular to find a way this connects to everything nicely. I think it's fair to say that this is a question mark at the moment. So I would like to conclude here and motivate you to start thinking about this in whatever direction you like. This is really, really a very interesting direction. And, well, we have local experts in all this part, Amit and Pedro. Okay? Thank you very much.
What is the status of the T compared with the L? Does the T give the same things as the L, or only for some particular shape?
No, by now, by now it's understood how this is related to L for all M and N. Well, there is a precise formula for this object for all M and N. And so Jake might help Pedro is asking, yeah. So the formula has been written down,
yeah.
For all M and N. Now how confident or has been proven that the connection between this and L or the T independence?
It's pretty hard in general above m equals 3 to see the t independence explicitly because there are many t's and it's really hard. Well, it's generally pretty hard in twister string to calculate these poles, but it's been checked explicitly for 8 part on square of HV, the t independence, the full multi-dimensional t independence.
Right.
And
I proved in general that twister strings are various PCFW recursion relations just directly without.
Yes, but his formula has been proven to be exactly the twister string.
Yeah.
Sorry?
The t formula.
The contour recursion
has not been proven to be exactly the twister string.
Okay, but the twister string directly computes PCFW terms, and all of those live in LM.
Yes, but that is not this formula. Or hasn't been, I'm sure it is, but it hasn't been proven to read this far.
Yeah. It has, but the contour deformation that you get from the description that you get in L and N from the twister string has been checked at 9 particles square inch feet. All 50 terms come out right.
What about CSWF loops? Do you think it will work? Do you think it will be possible to show that it works?
I hope so. I think that's very, very likely to be so.
Yeah.
Yeah, in particular, if you take the formula that Nima wrote down for MHV, right? Just write it in terms, so for MHV at one loop, you don't have the homogeneous terms, right? The homogeneous terms where you multiply one guy at three level with the one loop and so on. Those terms are not really there. What you have only is the forward limit terms. Now, the forward limit terms use the NMHV amplitude as a seed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, apply the same trick that we applied there, and that should give rise to the CSW expansion at one loop.
CSW at one loop for NMHV, it was not already that it works.
Well, what I'm telling you is how to do it, or how to do it in general. Or how to rederive it. I mean, the MHV... The proof, as far as I know, is complicated. I mean, you really have to be careful about all the caps and
right.
But this would be a straightforward proof. You just use a residue theorem and time. You just get the CSW. You would be completely free to do it.
Can you say that's what? How would you like to proceed? Suppose you know the integrand for any loop amplitude. Are you can get
no, well, the equation theory? Well, this is something that Nima said yesterday, but I'm sure he will repeat it today. The use of writing the integrand in terms of manifestly Jungian form is the following. Say to all loops for MHB amplitudes. You write it in manifestly Jungian form. If you use any closed contour, you will just get 1 as the answer. So there is nothing interesting there, right? But we know that the MHB amplitude is supposed to reproduce a Wilson loop, something very, very complicated with dying logs at one loop and very complicated functions at two loops and so on. So how can you go from the number 1 to something much, much more complicated? Well, what happens is that you now choose a contour, which is this contour that you get by this entanglement procedure that Nima explained yesterday, trying to associate, bring in a space-time. And so you're breaking the Jungian only by the choice of contour. So the full amplitude, all the complexity of the amplitude, is nothing but an infrared anomaly.
So you mean the 4 and 5 particle one? If you take the n particle...
No, the 4 and 5 particle ones are an infrared anomaly of the DCI. Of just the bosonic part. For any n.
Why did you say that for any, for large n, MHV, you'll get, irrespective of the contour, just for a closed contour, you'll only get 1?
Well, because the only Jungian invariant object with n equals to 2 or k equals 0 in momentum twisters, guess what it is? It's a number 1. I mean, you know that very well, yes. So that's the only thing that you can get in a nice contour. Now, everything else. So just by using the bosonic part of the dual conformal invariance, you cannot constrain the 6 particle amplitude and above. You can, anything that is made out of nice cross ratios would be dual conformal invariant, and therefore it will escape the anomaly, whatever anomaly equation that you can write down. But the super version of that anomaly will completely determine everything else, or it should determine everything else. If it's not just the super part of the dual conformal invariance, the super part of the full Jungian should be powerful enough to determine everything completely. Okay? So the goal at the moment is to find the infrared anomaly equations for the full Jungian. And that should be what determines the whole answer. Right? So that's the value in writing this thing in Jungian form. Manifestly Jungian form. It shows that the amplitude itself is nothing but an infrared anomaly. Okay? Any other questions?
Do you think that the integrand itself, well, also, you can resum this into a function that doesn't rely on perturbation?
That doesn't
rely on the perturbation theory.
That doesn't rely well, okay.
Can be
I think is irrelevant for that kind of questions. I mean, these questions are so far ahead that yeah, I could say whatever I want now. Nobody's gonna change it.
That's my point. The integral itself can be something like the string action.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, yeah. So you, what you're thinking is perhaps putting these things, finding a generating function, and trying to find the physical meaning. Well, there is a very nice work that was done less than a month ago by Sokachev, Kravchensky, and collaborators, where they claim to have discovered a new duality between correlation functions of operators. Okay. Of certain gauge invariant operators in the theory, in n equals 4 square Yang-Mills, where you take now the points where you insert the operators and you take them to be non-separated, you take that limit, and they claim that that object computes the integrand, is actually computing the integrand of the theory, or the square of the integral, of the integrand, for some reason which I don't understand. But that seems to be another mysterious connection that I don't know where it's coming from. Or whether it's true or not. It might just be true for MHV amplitudes. But that's another strange connection between off-shell physics and on-shell physics. Any other questions?
What about this generating function one?
Yes, that was Amit and Petro wrote down a generating function for.
But you did also with NEMA.
Oh, yeah. That would be very interesting. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Does it fit there? Does it fit?
Where would it fit? There's no room anymore. It doesn't fit anymore. We need another dimension. So. No, it doesn't fit there. No, yes, indeed. That would be spectacular to find a connection. Yeah, I think that now is the time to put that generating function to use. Yeah. Very good. All right. 2 hours, not bad. But I'll let you rest because.